This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because of the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
Hello, this is Elaine Scott, and I'm here today with Rick Stevens, my globetrotting co-host, and our very special guest, Sir Ken Robinson, a gentleman with whom Rick and I started a conversation, Sir Ken, may we say 10 years ago?
At least
we were in California together, actually working on a different project, and we had the opportunity to meet in your role as a director of education at the Getty Museum, and we started from there in a long-time collaboration around the ideas of innovation, human resources, creativity. And today we sit here 10 years after we had our first conversation about innovation and creativity, and we can see we've still got some work to do. So we're going to ask some questions about you, about your work. We've looked at your books. We've looked at Out of Our Minds, which I think has actually a new edition coming out. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right, yeah.
And we have Element, another one of your newest books, and we have the myriad of activities you've done globally, the TED Talks. But all of that in the palm of your hand doesn't help us much just naming it. What we want to hear from you is of those things and the effort that you've put into affecting creativity. Can you give us a little bit of an idea about where you think you've had the most success?
Yes. Actually, we met just after I'd moved to Los Angeles, which was 10 years ago this year. And as you say, it was at the Getty. I wasn't actually director of the museum education program. They had a wonderful person doing that. I was, at the time, the senior advisor to the Trust for Education. So I had a purview of all the Getty's work in education and was there for about 5 years. And that was my introduction to America. And, well, not my first. I'd been here several times before, but we moved here to take up that role initially. But I was also doing a lot of work around the country and have continued to do that for the, ever since I got here, and especially in the last 5 years. What I find is that I'm asked a lot to talk with different sorts of groups. I work with people in education. That's my background. It's where I came from. And I've worked across the country with groups and associations from kindergarten through to adult education. I work with businesses, as you know, particularly on issues to do with how you promote a culture of innovation. And I work, and always have done, with the cultural sector. I think that one index of the interest in the sorts of issues that I'm focused on is the impact of that TED Talk that you mentioned, which was in 2006, the first time I went to TED. And I gave an 18-minute talk there about education and creativity. And on the latest figures, that talk, I think, has been downloaded probably getting on for 6 million times now. But it's been shown constantly at conferences and events around the world. They reckon in about 150 countries. So if you multiply the download figure by, I don't know, 40 average people watching it, it's probably been seen by over 200 million people. Now, I say that not as a compliment to myself, but because there's a global interest in these issues about how do you promote creativity and what is it actually in the first place and what are the conditions under which it flourish. And I think that there is a movement growing around these issues. I feel it everywhere, and you feel it from all sorts of different sources. There was a report published, I'm sure you know it, last year by IBM, which was a survey of 3,000 CEOs around the world. And they identified creativity as their top priority. It appears all the time in conversations about education that the president in his State of the Union address last month talked about innovation as being one of the central pillars of America's future. So I think over the last 10 years, I would say there's been an increasing and accelerating awareness of the importance of having creativity and innovation at the center of our policies for the community, for education, and for business, and a growing interest in how to set about making that happen. And I think I can claim some role in helping at least to get that agenda firmly fixed into more people's minds.
So you asked three questions over and over again. I've seen them repeated in your work. What is essential to promote creativity? Why is it necessary to develop creativity? And what is involved in promoting creativity? What is creativity?
Well, my definition of it is that creativity is the process of having original ideas that have value. The process of having original ideas that have value. And it's an important question to start with. You know, I remember talking to a senior politician in the UK a number of years ago when I was asked to put together a national strategy for creativity in education. And I remember this particular politician saying to me, of course, the problem is you can't define creativity. And I remember saying, no, I think the problem is you can't. And I think it is a problem.
Right.
But people think they know what it is, and they base all sorts of misconceptions and I think mistaken arguments on the misconception of creativity. So often people think creativity is all about special people, you know, that it's a limited capacity that only a few people have. And that's an idea that's really perpetuated by our celebrity culture and also the iconic figures in innovation, you know, the Einsteins and the Edisons and the Martha Grahams. It's compounded by the fact a lot of people feel they're not very creative, and we might come back to why that is. It's often thought it's about special things, particularly the arts. I'm an unflagging advocate of the arts and education. But it's not, of course, limited to the arts. You can be creative at anything. And of course, science and mathematics and technology are deeply creative disciplines. And it's often thought there's nothing you can do about it. And actually, there's a lot you can do to make people more creative. And that's part of what I'm about, is helping people to see that creativity is an operational idea. You know, everyone occasionally has a good idea, but that's not the point. What you really want are organizations where creativity and innovation are routine, that it's systematic and reliable. And I think we can do that in the way that we know that we can promote literacy and numeracy reliably.
The idea of creativity is interesting. I'm very creative with thumbtacks. I can do amazing things with hanging pictures and doing displays. And while that's a very noble act, it belies the fact that I'm confident that if I make an effort to do something that's different or not like something I've done before, I'm confident that it's okay for me to go do that. There's a self-esteem issue there. And I wonder a little bit if we don't confuse people who have a sense of adventure or self-certainty or energy around trying new things, if that isn't a factor. And you don't teach that. Creativity is an outcome from people's need to solve problems.
Well, creativity is sometimes about solving problems. I mean, sometimes it's not. It's about finding new problems or having different questions to ask. And I always think that. I mean, if you look at Beethoven's Fifth, I'm not sure what problem it solved. If you look at Milton's Paradise Lost, you know, or any of the great works of art and literature. But in some cases, of course, it is directly applied to solving problems. I mean, that's what many of our great scientists and mathematicians are concerned with. But even there, you know, I know anyone who's involved in maths will say that mathematics is more than problem solving, that it's also a beautiful realm of ideas all to itself, and that there is a great aesthetic attraction for people who are drawn to mathematics in its purest forms. And also, that's true, I think, for people who work in engineering and in the sciences. So I'm always very keen to avoid strongly stereotyping these disciplines or associating creativity with one thing or another. But you are right that in every area, if you take this definition that creativity is the process of having original ideas that have value, it does take, on the one hand, a level of self-confidence to tackle developing new thoughts and ideas. It's the hardest work we often do, is to try and think something different. And it becomes even more difficult in organizational cultures where making mistakes is stigmatized, where people are frightened of appearing to have done the wrong thing. There has to be a willingness to take risks in any creative culture, and that's one of the roles of a creative leader, is to give permission to people to make mistakes.
Yeah, I thought you said that somewhere, and I remember just I was reading that the other day where it said you have to it has to be okay to be wrong,
yeah,
you know, or to make mistakes, and that's exactly right. That's a personal trait and a result of experiences with trying things, and I believe your summation about unfortunately the very institutions that we were hopeful that would help kids become creative, for example, are the institutions that drum it out of them because there's no room, really little room, for them to be creative, actually.
And that's been increasingly a problem in the U.S. over the past 10 years with this culture of standardized testing that's flowed from the No Child Left Behind legislation, where teachers and head teachers feel that they have to focus on a narrow set of priorities in schools, and that where their funding, indeed their very survival, is often tied to particular levels of performance in standardized tests. And of course, the whole thing about standardized tests is that they're looking normally for a single correct answer rather than multiple possible answers. It's the exact opposite of the kind of culture you need to promote divergence and difference. So I think you're right. And the great irony, of course, to me in all of this is that this culture of standardizing and conformity in education is stifling innovation and creativity among teachers as well as students at the very time when businesses are crying out for people to promote innovation. So a lot of what I've been trying to do is to, in my own way, is to encourage a joined up conversation between politicians, business and education leaders. Because at the moment, I think the problem is that schools are being inhibited in what politicians believe to be the interest of the economy. But you speak to people in business, and they have a completely different view of that.
Ken, if you think about this whole notion of what I'll use the term education and success, I think one of the ways that which people achieve education success is, one, they gather knowledge. They use that knowledge and experiences to be able to expand on, grow, and really understand key core concepts. And then they have relationships, which is interacting with others. And it's the integration and combination of those, which is really about what education should, in fact, be about.
Yes.
And there's this what I would call healthy tension between how do you help people understand core concepts? I'm a mathematician by training. There are certain core concepts that I need to understand because they set the rules and the foundation. On one hand, you want help people to understand the concepts. At the other hand, you don't want them to be bound by what the potential could be. Could you maybe talk about how the discussions could go on? Because my sense is, while we all see the challenges with NCLB and standardized testing, there is a certain amount of core concepts that people really need to understand as the foundation for being truly creative, as opposed to being creative, which has no value or capability because there's a fundamental missing concept, if I'm making sense.
Yeah. I think mathematics is a very good example of it, that you can't be, I think, creative in a fully fledged sense and continue to develop creatively without being in control of the materials that you're using. I mean, my argument, you know, is say that creativity is a process of having original ideas and have value. And the thing is, you can't be creative in the abstract. You have to do something to be creative. It's a very practical process. It can be cooking a meal. It can be playing music, composing music. It can be working on a mathematical problem. It can be designing an experiment. It can be running a business. But you have to do something. You would never say of somebody they were creative if they never did anything.
Right.
You know. So in a shorter way of describing creativity is applied imagination. It's putting your imagination to work in a particular field. For example, I cannot play the piano. I can tinkle on it, but I can't play it. I would like to, and I'd like to find time to do this at some point, and I really should. But I can't, therefore, I believe, be creative on the piano. Not really in the conventional musical sense. I mean, I could sort of bang at the keyboards and give vent to something, you know, but I might as well throw rocks at the wall as do that. To really be able to exploit the potential of the instrument, I need to be able to control it and be able to play it. And I don't have to be a virtuoso on it, before I can do anything that would, could be, I could consider creative in my own life. But I have to have some sense of how this thing works. You can't be creative in mathematics if you're enumerate. You have to have some, as you say, some grasp of the core concepts. I remember talking with one of the people I interviewed for the book I did, The Element, was Paul McCartney of the Beatles. And he said that when they started out, he and John Lennon only really knew two chords. But it turns out they were pretty good chords, you know. So they did quite a bit with it. But they heard that there was some guy across town in Liverpool who knew a third chord. And he said they got on the bus and went to see him and spent the afternoon. He taught them the third chord, and they said, thanks very much. And he went home and said, now we could start writing songs because we had the third chord. Well, of course, they got to learn a lot more chords as life went on. What this points to me is that the real trick of this is, that, firstly, that there is no conflict between knowledge and discipline and control and creativity. On the contrary, your creative capacities grow as your command of the materials increases. But it's equally possible to drill people just in core concepts and information and knowledge in a way that stultifies any creative interest they might have in putting these things to work. You know that. That's one of the big problems of certain types of rote teaching. So what this has implications for me is the nature of teaching. There are certain implications here for creative pedagogy. I remember we had this very conversation with the ministers in the UK who were saying, you know, creativity is very important, but we have to get people to master the core concepts of literacy and numeracy. And this simply indicated to me they'd misunderstood the entire argument, that the way you get people to engage with these ideas is to fire their imaginations with them and get them to see the creative possibilities of them. And people learn much more and much more thoroughly and more quickly when they internalize these ideas, and they're more likely to do that if their imaginations are engaged.
Let me tie back real quickly to two ideas, one that you mentioned early on and then this one about John Lennon being creative with basic concepts. I grant you that Beethoven probably didn't solve a problem that either you or I knew about. But maybe the problem, and in creative people, there is this urge, or is this, as Sir Ken Robinson might say, a passion to get something out. And it's there, and it needs to be expressed. And he had what you call the skill sets to make that happen.
Yeah.
But for him, it was a problem. He needed to get that out. He had to do that. In the same way that John Lennon and Paul McCartney had to get their music out. It was a problem for them. It really was a problem, and not a problem that you and I would call something that was, for us, would be life or death. But for them, in their own way, because of who and what their passion was, it was a problem they were solving. So in terms of people having basic concepts and what teachers can do to work with kids, I'm bringing this back around to what teachers see in kids. If we're talking to people about helping teachers become and adults work more with kids to enliven or bring up that creativity, do we somehow mistake sometimes a passion to express yourself in some way as something that just needs to be, is an emotional thing to be managed rather than a real desire or need to express yourself? And maybe they need just exactly what you just said. I'm just marveling at what you just said. Maybe they need two or three core concepts and then they can really be creative and they're just not getting them.
Yeah, I think, by the way, I agree with you. I do think that a musician might say that Beethoven solved all kinds of problems through his composition, and I'm sure he faced many in the writing of that particular symphony. I'm just glossing what you're saying, that simply describing it, though, as problem-solving doesn't seem to me to capture the complexity of what really goes on here.
Okay.
You know, it's not quite the same thing as trying to figure out the solution to a logical difficulty of some sort. But you're right. I think that people in their element, which is what, you know, what the book describes, are driven by a deep passion and compulsion to tackle new horizons and to push the boundaries of their own understanding and knowledge. And they encounter all kinds of challenges and problems in the way of doing that. Can I just give you a quick example of this idea of the creative approach to core concepts? A friend of mine who's a very good educator in the UK was telling me, you know, we had a national literacy strategy. We still do in the UK. And one of the requirements, of course, is that the strategy has to teach all the children in the elementary schools core grammatical concepts and principles. For example, paragraphing. And this friend of mine, Richard Gerver, was teaching a group, I think there were 9-year-olds, but he got to this point in the literacy strategy where they had to cover paragraphing, Well, you know how exciting that can be, you know, as a topic. So he thought, well, how am I going to get this, get the kids engaged in this, you know? And so he went.
It's amazing.
That's right. He went in this first morning for this session, and he asked the class if they knew the soap opera EastEnders. It's not well known in this country, but in Britain, it's one of the top weekly soap operas. And everybody seems to watch it. And they said, well, of course we do. And he said to them, would you like to watch an episode of it? And they said, what now? You know, this is Monday morning in school. And he said, yeah, now I've got a DVD. Do you want to watch an episode? And they said, well, duh, you know. So they watched this episode. It's 25 minutes, I think it was. And so at the end of it, he said, look, I don't know this show, so tell me what's going on. So they all described the stories and the characters and what was happening. And then he said to them, you know, why do they keep moving the camera around in this way? And they gradually explained the principles of cutting a movie. And then the next day, he read them a story and showed them the pages he was reading from and asked them why they thought the paragraphs were broken up in that way, why the page was broken up in that way.
Brilliant.
And they made a direct connection between editing a movie and paragraphing a book.
Brilliant.
And
brilliant.
It's a lesson they've never forgotten.
Brilliant.
We want to bring us right back and continue with this conversation with Ken Robinson.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips-Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
This system, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birthtowork.org or amazon.com.
Welcome back. This is Elaine Scott, Rick Stevens, and we're talking with Sir Ken Robinson, a very much in-demand speaker on creativity and innovation throughout the world. We're drilling down and really looking a lot closer at some of your core concepts, Sir Ken, on creativity and innovation. And we were just talking about a teacher who used the world of experience that the kids in his class had around watching a movie and guided them through some questions, having had them relook at something they were already familiar with. Absolutely a brilliant move. Then he moved that to reading and showed how the paragraphs and the writing of a story has a very similar kind of editing process. And go ahead and tell us a little bit more now about, as you thought about that as an example, how you've seen that in other environments as well.
Well, what happened in that particular case was that what he discussed with the kids is that when you're writing on a page, the writer doesn't have a camera to move around. So what the writer can do is move the text around. And they got that analogy absolutely. And the final bit of that sequence, by the way, just for interest, was the next lesson. He took them in two pages of completely unformatted text and got them into groups of two and three and asked them to divide the page up in the way that they thought had the biggest impact and helped to bring the story to life in the best way. And he said it's very interesting because you know, within 5 minutes, these kids were on their feet, kind of shouting at each other, saying, that's ridiculous. You'd never put a paragraph there. You know, why would you do that? You know, that's breaking up somebody's conversation. Well, you know, they had internalized the concepts, and they would never have forgotten them. And as we're saying, there's an alternative way of doing this, which is that he could have said to the class at the beginning, look, here are the sort of 8 or 10 reasons that we have paragraphs, so I want you to memorize this list, and we're going to have a test. But they had memorized them, they'd internalized them, because they'd been applying them actively in a way that made sense to them. And that, to me, is a very good example of creative teaching. I put together a national strategy in the UK for creativity in education, not alone, but with a group of people, 10 years ago. And we make a distinction in there between teaching creatively and teaching for creativity. And what we mean by the first is that all great teachers are naturally creative in the way they engage people. Teaching itself is an art form. And something that's required of all great teachers, of course, is knowledge of their discipline and their grasp of the field. But I know lots of people who are very knowledgeable in their disciplines but have no sense of how to engage other people in it or to teach them. They simply stultify them. Great teachers are not only knowledgeable in their field and have an expertise, but their expertise includes firing up the imaginations and interests of their students so that the students willingly engage in learning. And the problem with a lot of these approaches to standardized testing is, of course, it negates the interests of the learners. It simply makes them, or attempts to make them, into receptacles. So teaching creatively is, to me, the lifeblood of all great teaching. Teaching for creativity is about creating situations where people can develop their own creative powers and potential. And that's something that can happen across the entire school curriculum. It can happen in every part of an organization, too. It's creating conditions for people to exercise their imaginations.
Is there a sense, Ken, about where is the right time to start developing that from birth or after some of the core concepts are in place, which can be, you know, vary depending upon what's going on by subject or discipline? What's your experience? Because certainly business leaders struggle with that until people understand what are the values of a company or an organization. And then being able to say, now, given that, now I'm ready to create the environment. Without that core, you certainly can't have people, for example, creating airplanes that don't have as a fundamental core. It's all about safety and reliability. So your thoughts on that?
I was actually at a meeting yesterday in Orange County talking with a whole group of about 1,000 people from business, from education, and from the cultural sector. But I was talking to some of the people from Boeing there and saying that I think creating an aircraft is one of the most extraordinary examples of creativity and innovation I could imagine. To engineer, design, conceive of, and build a 747 and its successors is the most extraordinary tribute to human ingenuity and ability. And it's a very good example to me because creativity often relies upon constraints. It's not a free-for-all. It's not, well, let's do anything we feel like here. That can be the case in some settings. But to take another example, I'm a patron of the London School of Contemporary Dance. And they produce work of the highest international quality. And if you watch professional dancers at work and in rehearsal and in choreography, it's really tough, disciplined activity. It's physically tough, it's intellectually challenging and demanding, it's emotionally demanding, it requires knowledge of the music, of yourself, of the space, reciprocity with other people that you're dancing with. It's simply not the case in any field where creativity is highly valued that it's simply letting people loosen off the leash and let them go and do whatever they want. And of course, as you say, when you're designing aircraft, there are certain absolutely immutable principles that have to be obeyed, you know, including safety and reliability. And those things don't seem to me limit the creative potential for design. They create a framework for it. And there are wonderful examples of people coming up with very different designs, but within those core constraints. So I'm always very keen to say that the creativity is not simply licensed to do anything in an unfettered way. For example, I was speaking, you say you're a mathematician, Rick. I was speaking years ago now to, when I was teaching at Warwick University, to a professor of pure mathematics. And I asked him how he would assess a PhD in pure mathematics. And he said there were really two criteria. The first was originality. In other words, it had to break new ground.
Yes.
But, of course, break new ground in a way that was persuasive to other mathematicians who understood the field and would apply the highest test to it. That it had to be original within its field. And the criteria you apply are relevant to the field. I mean, nobody was asking that it had to be an original contribution to modern jazz or to dance, but to its particular discipline. But the second thing I loved, you know, which was that he said the second criterion for assessing a PhD in pure math is aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why is that important? He said, because mathematicians believe that mathematics is one of the purest ways we have of describing the truths of nature. And since nature is inherently beautiful, the more elegant the proof, the more likely it appears to us to be true, to correspond to the truths of nature. I just think that's wonderful. You know, he could have been describing a sonata or a poem. And in a way, he was, of course. So it's not the freedom from constraints. It's not that creativity depends upon freedom from constraints. It's how well people operate within these core concepts, often that creates the most original contribution. But, of course, every now and then, you'll get a completely groundbreaking, paradigm-shifting innovation, which changes the rules of the game itself.
Yes. Well, many of the examples you've used to describe, Ken, have been related to things in the real world. One of the things that Elaine and I debate on is about the value of a computer, particularly from the standpoint that many of our children today, on average, spend 7.5 hours each day tied in some sort of what we call the simulated world, whether it's the TV, whether it's the computer, whether it's the Xbox game, whether it's tied to some digital world. And when they're listening or engaging and things don't go in the right direction or there are issues, they have the ability in the simulated world to hit the ONOFF switch and turn it off and walk away without consequences. Do you have a perspective or a set of observations as we look at the value that the computer has to either help enhance an individual's ability to be more creative, less creative, or do you think it doesn't have an impact one way or the other on this concept of creativity?
Well, I think they have huge implications for creativity. All technology does. I remember once we were interviewing somebody for a post at the university in technology education, and we interviewed, I think it was 10 people, and I asked each of them what technology is. And I was amazed by how difficult they found it to describe what technology is. And they went all around the houses and came up with all kinds of elaborate versions of it. And all I really wanted somebody to say was that technology is the design and use of tools, which it is. And tools are central to almost all forms of creativity. And new tools always open up new creative horizons. I mean, you think of how the camera opened up the world of, you know, whole new dimensions in the visual arts, of how the symphony orchestra, which is really a technology, how the design of new instruments and the introduction of new sorts of techniques for shaping metal and wood, how they massively expanded the repertory. When Beethoven was composing his music, he was composing it for a set of orchestral instruments that weren't available, you know, in the early Baroque period. And it's one of the reasons why music has evolved as it has, because people have seen the creative potential of new tools and possibilities. And the new technologies, the digital technologies, create enormous opportunities. I'm thinking of, for example, CGI, you know, which has proved to open up an entirely new field of cinema. If you look at the work of Pixar. The kids have at their disposal now, young people, we all have at our disposal, unprecedented tools for creative work. But, of course, the tools themselves are completely neutral. I mean, a camera itself doesn't produce works of art. It produces them in the hands of an artist. A laboratory in itself doesn't produce scientific breakthroughs. It only produces that if you have scientists in there who know how to use the equipment and are inspired and have a sense of purpose and direction and have a facility with all of these tools. So I think the tools, no matter how sophisticated they get, are essentially neutral. It's all about how we use them and how well we're enabled to use them and to see the creative possibilities that they offer to us. So I'm very optimistic about these tools. I think they provide wonderful opportunities for all of us. Our kids are actually much better very often at seeing the creative potential in them than some of our teachers and certainly people of my generation are. The one area that I feel caution around here is that I think they limit in some other respects creative opportunities for young people. Like, for example, the social media, Facebook and so on, in a way are kind of ironically entitled as social media because there is an experience to be had by being face-to-face with people in the same room, feeling their energy, which you don't get even through Skyping with them. And you certainly don't get just by exchanging emails with people. And to some extent, the social media, I say they're slightly ironically titled because they encourage a kind of atomism, I think, from people. They can tend to discourage people from meeting face-to-face, and I'm a great believer in people connecting. For example, in schools, I think there are huge opportunities with these new technologies to personalize education. There's a school in New York actually now called the School of One, which is using quite a sophisticated computer program to personalize every child's curriculum every day. And it's a very interesting experiment. We'll see how far it will go. But there are things, there are experiences to be had from, for example, working in teams in the same room collaboratively. And I'm a great believer in that from the point of view of the arts, for example. There are things to be gained from being face-to-face with people working on theater productions or in dance or in the same studios with them, from using physical materials rather than digital materials. And I think it would be a great mistake to sacrifice those experiences in the pursuit only of the creative potential of the new technologies.
Knowledge without application, without being applied, is of no value. I mean, you can have a lot of training and you can have a lot of knowledge, but if you have no inspiration and no application, you don't have anything. It's a self-amusement, but your concept here about the use of technology that limits human experience, real human experience, is one of our concerns as well.
It can, and I think, I mean, just in the ways I'm describing, I think that the loss of hands-on practical activities of other sorts would be very regrettable, and I'd certainly want to talk against that happening. But the other thing we don't know, and this is, like I say, this is not to argue in some Luddite way against the creative potential. On the contrary, I'm all for it. But we don't know either at the moment. And I don't mean we do know. We don't know what effect, if any, the constant exposure to screens may have on the development of children's neural pathways, on their cognitive development. We simply don't know that. It's an untested experiment, any more than we don't know what the effect is of having cell phones plugged to your ear, for years and end, maybe. We simply don't know, and I think we should be cautious about it until we're clearer what sustained exposure to these technologies, what effect, if any, they may have on developing minds and brains.
There's a considerable body of knowledge, actually, on that, and the issue is not what we know or don't know. It's what we are speculating and what we can never really know fully. You know, there are many things that we do that are simply social experiments because there's a potential financial loss on behalf of medical practitioners if they don't make a certain suggestion and make it stick and they all agree to it. It's not really based on what they know. It's based on what they believe is true.
Okay.
And the general problem is you come back years later and they go, wow, if only we'd known that then. But that's a conversation that goes back 30 years for me as I've been looking at that exact issue and have seen volumes of data on the reasons why spending so much time in front of the screen is not useful to you. And I hearken back to your example of dancing, for example, and I remember one of my daughter's favorite musicals was A Chorus Line. And in A Chorus Line, part of the audition, one young girl was asked to pretend like she was bobsledding, and she was supposed to be pretending like she was. And she said, I'm from Puerto Rico. We don't bobsled in Puerto Rico. Right?
Yeah.
And so you do have a limitation in terms of what you can express physically if you don't really have experiences to go along with it. I mean, you can pretend, but you really can't know what that is, like asking someone to feel like what it means to be a parent.
That's right.
Until you are a parent, you don't really know. And I'm circling back to your conversation about, in the beginning when we talked about teaching and training, about knowing your material and being comfortable with your material. But I think about the people in science and technology in particular who go through school, and for the most part, they're labeled. They're the geeks, and they're the people who aren't very good at conversation, and they're not very good at engaging people. And they're mostly people who have a lot of information and knowledge. And yet now, at an age of creativity and innovation, one of the things that we've done is we've cut out the arts from schools. A lot of the opportunity for expression in those areas has been eliminated or is considered too fluffy. And the people who are rewarded for having knowledge are not necessarily rewarded for being able to be engaging. Is that part of the process of drumming out of people this capacity or capability to be creative and innovative in terms of how to engage other people? I think your comment was spot on. You have to be able to, the good teachers engage people. But if that's not what they were rewarded for, then we can take a look at some possibilities for education that are about really affirming and raising this knowledge to the surface or this thought.
Well, it's interesting, you know, one of the highest performing education systems in the world is and has been for some time Finland. And often American policymakers look to other countries like Finland, Singapore, and say, well, you know, we should be emulating their results in maths and science. And what's really interesting, of course, is that in Finland, they do have high results in maths and science, but it's not because they focus on them exclusively. On the contrary, they don't. They have a very broad curriculum. They have a curriculum that gives equal places to the arts, the humanities, the physical education. They have great music programs. And I was with some of the people from the Finnish education system a little while ago, and they said the reason we're so successful in these particular areas is because we have a very broad approach, and we aim to encourage all children to explore the wide range of their abilities and to encourage each of them to develop their own particular interests and talents. They don't have any standardized testing, for example, or in Finland, or very little. And I remember some American educators at the same meeting saying to the people from Finland, you know, what's the dropout rate in schools in Finland? Because it's about 30% now, isn't it, in the U.S.?
Yes,
it is.
Said, you know, what's the dropout rate from high school in Finland? And they said, well, we don't know what you mean. There isn't a dropout rate. Kids don't drop out. And why would they? Because the system engages them. And it's so axiomatic, this, that we're not trying to run a system, or shouldn't be trying to run a system in order to raise test scores. Our purpose ought to be to educate students. And all students are unique. They all have their own interests and abilities and talents and passions and preoccupations. And the reason so many kids are dropping out of school is because they don't find it of any interest. It doesn't engage them. And it's significant to me that the remedial programs that work, that are designed to get kids back into education, are based on personalized curricula. You know, eventually, they look in their eyes and say, well, who are you? And what is it that would interest you? And all it comes to me is this principle that education is inherently and inevitably personal. These are people we're dealing with. And people perform best, in the broadest sense, when they're engaged and they feel that they matter. You know, there was a time where the Fordist model reigned supreme, where the principles of Taylorism and time and motion and high efficiency in manufacturing really counted most. And it didn't really matter who was doing the work. I mean, anybody could do it, providing they did it as prescribed. But if you want an organization that puts a premium on innovation and creative output and new thinking, then it really does matter who's doing it. And it matters to them whether they're valued or not and how they're valued. And in education, it always mattered that we took the individual seriously as well as thought collectively about the culture of the whole school. So it's an argument to me for holism, that we have to provide a broad education because it speaks to the wide range of people's abilities. It recognizes and gives more opportunity for individual talents to emerge. But also, something we haven't yet mentioned is that often real creative innovation comes from people making connections between disciplines. It's something that Steve Jobs was talking about recently at the launch of the iPad. He said, you know, their culture depends on not just technology. It depends on the interaction of artists and musicians and scientists and designers, and all great companies do. They They work through synergies. So I think it's important to recognize that we were looking for a holistic solution here and not a partial one.
Well, speaking of connections, I want to tell you how much we have enjoyed this conversation, and we look forward to an opportunity for another show. We didn't get nearly as far as we would have liked, but we did do one thing. We did establish that there is a basis for understanding creativity and technology and innovation in a way, I think, that is new and different than I've seen out in the marketplace as far as you're concerned and what other people are concerned. And I hope you share that enthusiasm with me. And I'd like for you to let the people know what your website is.
It's www.kenrobinson.com. And the new book is Out of Our Minds, Learning to Be Creative. And as you say, the other one is The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything.
And we look forward to talking with you again. This is Elaine Scott.
Rick Stevens.
And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birthtowork.org. That's birth, the number two, work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birthtowork.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.